Hello, Port Townsend. You're listening to 91.9 FM KPTZ, and you're about to hear two shows designed to whet your appetite for the 2017 Women in Film Festival. Jeanette Force, our Intrepid Film Institute's executive director, and Jane Julian have combed the world to once again bring you a wide range of amazing films offered by a diverse group of filmmakers. Larry Stein, KPTZ program director, and Marsha Pearlstein, your friendly neighborhood interviewer, will be conducting these interviews. So sit back and imagine yourselves coming to the movies April 8th and 9th for the Women in Film Festival here in Port Townsend. This is our special edition of the Women in Film interviews to whet your appetite for all that's about to come. And I have the most amazing honor of interviewing Mr. Terrence Davies. This man is a novelist, a director, a screenwriter, a man who knows all kinds of things about film, and he is with us on the phone. Welcome, Terrence.
Oh, thank you very much. What an introduction.
And by the way, filmgoers, you can see many other of Mr. Davies' films on Netflix, but for the festival, you're going to want to come out and see A Quiet Passion, and it's all about Emily Dickinson. So the first and most obvious question, Terrence, is what made you decide to focus on our Miss Dickinson?
I discovered her poetry when I was 18. Claire Bloom was reading Because I Could Not Stop for Death, and I ran out and bought a very, very small anthology and read it. And then about 10 or 15 years ago, I started rereading her, and I thought, this is really an extraordinary life. And so I read six biographies and thought, this is something that I think I can do. I responded to spiritual crisis, because she did have one, whether there was a soul and therefore no God, what do you do? But also the thing that I think moved me more than anything else is that these poems are so avant-garde, but they are so beautiful. For her not to have been recognized in her own lifetime, I do think that's just awful. That was also part of it as well. I want people to go out and read her all the time. I think she deserved fame during her lifetime, but she didn't get it. So the least we can do is try and make sure that people start reading her again.
I think so many of us start reading her as teenagers and can't let go. And certainly with this film, you have a more nuanced, deeper understanding. How did you form your point of view about her? Because it's a little bit different than many others have reported, and I was entranced by that.
The thing about doing from one point of view, it actually cuts down a lot that you can't have, because if she's not there with these other people, then we can't have scenes in which she was not privy to. You know, that therefore makes it easier. And because of the closeness of the family, and I had a very close family myself, that arc was already there. I knew that that's what I wanted to do. But what happens is, of course, this great schism when her brother, Austin, has an affair with Mabel Loomis Todd, who's a married woman. That is of such importance in the family because it created this great schism. And Emily was absolutely appalled by it because, you know, she has these very high standards for herself, but she has them for other people as well, which is why when the two moments in the film where she castigates herself, she says, I've got equally the great number of faults, but her sense of integrity and the bar at which that's set is so high, I think very few people could actually reach it. And I don't think she realized that because of that rigor of the soul and moral and ethical rigor.
But also it was so multi-layered. She wasn't being purely judgmental. She was also being an advocate for her sister-in-law. And you began to see her concern for all members of the family. It started out, of course, her relationship with her dad. Yes, there was some judgment, and yes, she did hold herself to high standards, but she really tried to put herself in other people's shoes and stick up for them, and especially women in this case.
Yes, I think she does. I think she would have been a very, very good friend, you know, to anyone. But the problem with that is that she still has very high standards. Within that, they've got to reach the depth of emotion that she gives it. Well, very few people can actually do that. I mean, even Riding, who's actually Vinny's friend, not Emily's. Even Riling, who is wonderful company and encourages the rebelliousness in Emily, but also says, you know, you can't take it too far. You've got to know when to stop. And that's the problem when someone is so radical like Emily. She doesn't know when to stop. And that's part of the pain that she receives in life because she's unable to see that, and or she's too unable to see it too late. I mean, someone said to me many years ago, and it really is true, sometimes it's better to be kind than be in the right. And I don't think she ever makes that distinction.
You portrayed her as feisty and opinionated and not backing down, and she had kind of a zest and an energy that most people focus on her rich interior life. You brought us full circle to all of her.
She's a woman, you know, who's like everyone else. She was a human being. You know, she liked to garden. She played the piano. She improvised very well, apparently. And I think she had a good sense of humor. You know, she just happened to be a genius. that's the one thing. Good, like all geniuses, she has one skin less. But I didn't want her to be solemn. I wanted her to be jolly. I wanted to see that she could have a laugh and take life not too seriously. Because that's part of it as well. She was an ordinary woman who happened to be a genius.
She was not only connecting with people, her rich interior life, but nature. Nature soothed her. Nature, I think, inspired her. And what I loved about your film is the quality of her connection with nature. You went so large and yet so small in terms of detail that it was just terrific.
I mean, when she was living in the house, I mean, opposite her was a meadow, and in the very, very far distance was a factory you could barely see that made Panama hats, of all things. It was very rural, not built up as it is now. So that informs everything, you know, because A, not only is it just that much slower, but it's much more difficult to keep in touch with people, either by letter, you know, or by physically seeing them. But it was very, very rural. Amherst was very, very rural.
And I think that setting accompanied a lot of what she came out with. I thought that the heroine of Sunset Song had similarities to Emily Dickinson. She wasn't a genius, but she had some of her determination, her perspicacity, her feistiness. Did you see many things in common between the two women on both sides of the pond and one?
I think they are alike, only in the sense of what they are put through. Chris, in Sunset Song, is young enough to start again. That's the implied hope at the end of it, and that she forgives all suffering. There isn't that option for Emily. She's got Bright's disease. In fact, she died from congenital heart disease, not just that. Didn't go anywhere, apparently. Didn't have, you know, lovers, although I think she wanted one, but was terrified of it as well. You know, why Sunset Song ends in an implied hope is because this girl is young. She's realized that you can forgive, and if you forgive, then you can go on. What happens with Emily is she, in a way, succumbs to death and mortality and hopes that she will not face complete extinction. If you like, the two are the reverse coins. Each one side is one side of the coin. You can either have that on the one hand or not have it on the other.
You're right. Flipped around bookends. I encourage people to see Sunset Song as well. You started off, the first thing you did was your novel, which was said to be highly autobiographical. What was that like?
It wasn't sort of autobiographical for me, but what you do, you bring to it certain things that are deep within you. You know, I mean, where Emily is concerned, you know, my own spiritual crisis and the fact that I was in a family, a large family, and I never wanted them to change. Like, she doesn't want it hurt family to change, and that is something that will, it does. We all would love to be, you know, in the Smith family and meet me in St. Louis. Unfortunately, real life isn't like that. But you bring those things to you, that sense of what is spiritual, what do we hope for, how do we live in the face of extinction, and also little joys of life, you know, reading, seeing the light change, just being with your family or your friends, those small things which are of huge importance. But all those are autobiographical because we all know what that's like. So, I mean, each film, I suppose, there's a little bit more of you in each film. And in fact, my manager said, well, Emily is concerned that it's my most autobiographical film. And I think he's probably right.
I also noted that one critic indicated that you had a good deal of trouble each time starting out, getting the proper backing and getting the support for all of your films, that it was a very slow and very difficult process. Do you think that informs your current work?
I don't know. I think it does change you. I mean, I didn't work for nearly 10 years. But yes, it will always be difficult when you don't work in the mainstream. The way I perceive cinema isn't going to make me a household name. It will always be difficult raising the funds because of the types of themes I choose, and also because I cast the people who are right. I don't care whether they're well-known or unknown. If they're right for it, they get the role, you know, and I'll fight for that. But it is always difficult. It just is always difficult.
Do you prefer directing or having another director direct your screenplays?
I've never done anyone else's screenplay. I've always written my own because the ones I've been sent, I just couldn't see. And there's no point in me doing it because I don't know where the camera positions are. I don't know anything. I've always written my own work.
Have other people directed your work that you've written?
No.
So you're the whole package.
Yes, I'm afraid so.
Oh, don't be afraid. It's a wonderful thing. I guess it's really a matter of artistic control, and you're willing to hold out and have it be more difficult to raise money in order to have total control in that sense.
From the earliest days when I'm making my first trilogy, I knew I wasn't Hollywood material. I just know I would die within five days in Hollywood. Now, you know, that's not the way I see cinema, and I couldn't make it like that. And, you know, and also part of me thinks the main actors being given these huge amounts of money, no one's worth it. I don't care how talented they are. No one's worth it.
What are you working on now? I read somewhere you had two projects in motion, but they didn't mention what.
There's an American novel called Mother of Sorrows by a man called Richard McCann, who sent it to me out of the blue, and where I've written the final script for that, we're raising the money and we're casting. Paul Dano has kindly said that he would like to do it, and I'm writing a film about Siegfried Sassoon so that it will be out 2018 for the 100th anniversary of the end of the First World War.
Well, Terrence Davies, thank you so much for speaking with us. Final question, is there anything I didn't ask you that people should hear?
All I could say is that I have tried to do Emily proud. And I will never be able to prove this, but I think if she's up there somewhere and she likes it, I hope she thinks I feel a poem coming on.
It's been our pleasure. Terrence Davies,
thank you.
This is KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. Terrence is the creator of A Quiet Passion, the director, the person who lived with Emily Dickinson since he was 18 years old in his soul, and he has represented her well. Thank you again, Terrence.
You're more than welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM Port Townsend. I'm Larry Stein. I'm speaking to Mercedes Kane, the director, or producer-director, maybe more correctly, of Breakfast at Ina's, a film that's finishing up the Women in Film Festival this year at the Port Townsend Film Festival, April 8th and 9th. Mercedes is talking to me from Chicago, where she lives and works, and of course that is very much the setting of Breakfast at Ina's. Mercedes, thanks for taking some time to talk.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Give us a picture of Ina's breakfast place in the world of Chicago. I mean, separate from the film, what's the place that her restaurant held in that community?
You know, I think that's one of the things that was so unique about Ina and her restaurant is that, you know, it's in the West Loop neighborhood. And it kind of came up in the West Loop when that wasn't a really up and coming area. Now it is, but it was one of the first restaurants there. And I think it really drew a lot of people to that area. But even though it was kind of in the heart of, you know, the bustling city, it really did have sort of a down home feel. I mean, some of her customers described it as a village, and she really knew everybody by name, and she was there to greet everybody almost every single day. So even though it was, you know, in the city and kind of a rough area at first and then a really bustling area, it felt kind of small town because of Ina's personality and because of the relationships that she really developed with all of her customers.
I think people can really relate to this because just about whatever community you live in, there's often a favorite breakfast joint that everybody gathers at. I know we have one or two in Port Townsend that people are regulars at in the morning, and they go and everybody knows your name. It's just like the Cheers bar. Everybody knows your name.
Right.
But Ina's personality is really what drives the popularity of Ina as well. Actually, we don't get to see or talk about the food too much in the film. I assume the food is really excellent too. That's what draws the people. But Ina's personality is kind of the glue that holds everything together at Ina's.
She definitely has a unique personality and a strong personality in kind of a good way, I think. She really made the experience for her customers about her customers, and I think that they probably didn't realize all of the layers to her unless they really knew her, which a lot of them did because she did develop relationships. She's been in the restaurant industry in Chicago for, I think it was about 36 years at the time of her closing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she had gone through a lot of trials and tribulations in her own life, but when people came to the restaurant, she really made it all about them and didn't focus on herself. And so I think that was something that people loved.
It's hard to tell you the stories that have come my way. I'm still having more trouble with the children. Yesterday, a four-year-old who's not been very demonstrative and not very forthcoming, but always kind of looks at me like this when he's here, he came over to the table and put his hands out for me to hold. And he said, "Miss Ina, please don't go away." And I held him and I said, "It's time for change, and you'll learn how that feels later."
She wanted to treat her customers in a very special way, and you see that, and they feel that way. But was she reticent about talking about her own life to them? Did she pretty much keep her own trials and tribulations, as you say, to herself, or did she share with long-term customers?
I think she did keep a lot of it to herself. I know a lot of the customers didn't even, you know, Ina was diagnosed at 18 months with polio, and one of the big reasons that she decided to close her doors in 2013 was because of complications with post-polio syndrome. And, you know, she had a lot of debilitation with her movements and a lot of pain. A lot of her customers didn't even really know she had polio.
Mm-hmm.
Even though she did have a limp, she never used a cane at her restaurant. She kind of just suffered through it. I don't think she ever wanted to put any of that on them. She wanted them to come and enjoy the restaurant, enjoy the experience, enjoy the food, and, you know, their family. A lot of them had some really strong family memories and celebrated some special events there, and she wanted to make it about that. So unless, you know, they got to really know her outside of the restaurant, I don't think that they knew much about her past.
The film covers the last about approximately 30 days of the restaurant's opening, and there's a wonderful countdown to the closing day, which of course is the end of the film. But what you see is lots of longtime customers coming in and sharing their attachment and their feelings and their love for Ina. And you can see that some of the young people must have grown up at that restaurant. And you don't even have to say it. You can see it, that these young people in their 20s coming in, and you can fill in the dots that they started coming there when they were 3 or 4.
A lot of people even, you know, had been coming since they were little, and then they were bringing their own kids there. And so Ina got to know generations of families, which, again, I think is something unique, especially in a city like Chicago, where there's always, like, the latest, newest, trendy restaurant that people kind of flock to. So to have a restaurant with that kind of staying power that people would come to when they were 5 years old and then end up bringing their five-year-olds, you know, however many years later, is really kind of unique and special, and I think a testament to Ina and what she kind of built there.
That's right. Well, like any good documentary, we get to see very deeply, really, into Ina and her history. And it's not just about a popular restaurant and the people who love it and the food. It's about Ina's life, and it's, in a way, it's her chance to share even though she doesn't want to dump her troubles on anybody else, but share her very complex life. And I think it's exactly what a good documentary should do.
So I had actually read a story about Ina in the Chicago Tribune. It was about, you know, her upcoming closing, and it did delve into her life, probably not as deeply as we did in the documentary, but it touched on a few different things. She was diagnosed with polio at a very young age. She was in an interracial marriage for many, many years that started in the 60s and basically was disowned by her family because of that. You know, she became this female entrepreneur at a time that just wasn't the norm. You know, you see this breakfast restaurant and maybe don't think much about the owner, but when you start to kind of peel back those layers, you realize, wow, like this woman has really overcome a lot and has a lot of layers to her story. And so I contacted Ina, and we, her and me and Sanghoon Lee, who was the producer, cinematographer, we all got together at her restaurant. Of course, we had a wonderful meal with her. You know, we talked about her opening up about these different aspects of her life, and she was really open to it. You know, she wanted me to tell a story, you know, her story with integrity, and then she promised back to me that she would be open and honest about it. That was kind of a promise we made in that first meeting, and I think we both upheld our ends of it throughout the filming of the movie.
It's a fitting parallel to the way she runs her business. You can see that as you watch Ina interacting with her customers, that's the way she ran her business, and that's why people flocked to the restaurant, and that's why people felt so attached to her. Tell us a little bit. You don't focus much on the food, but just for us foodies out there, tell us what's the hallmark of the food at Ina's that drew people.
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing about Ina is she was never professionally trained as a chef. She really taught herself everything she knew, and we don't get into so much of the history of that part of it just because there was so much to touch on. But she really did start in like the kitchen of her house selling cakes, like out of her house, until she opened a bakery and then turned that into a restaurant. But she's really great with like the baking aspect of it. Mm-hmm. So all of her, you know, she had this like very famous coffee cake that was incredible. Just a lot of really kind of home style cooking, I would say. You know, she had this delicious frittata, and also I think she took a lot of pride in her actual ingredients. She like sourced things from local farms before that was even, you know, really a thing. She, you know, she was really involved in the community too, and making sure that, you know, people were using pasteurized eggs and kind of using these really quality ingredients that were not full of pesticides and kind of things that people are more focused on now. She was doing that a long time ago. So I think everything is really kind of what you would expect of, you know, a grandma's house, or someone that really kind of does feel homey and comforting. You know, her food was really that way. Ina has a cookbook that's actually done quite well, but there's still brunch restaurants all around the city that do special events and feature Ina's, you know, certain menu items. Heavenly Hots, which were these pancakes that she was famous for, and they'll have her come there and they'll make them, and people will kind of flock there just to get another taste of it.
Wonderful. It's part of the Chicago, wonderful Chicago personality and history. Now, yeah, since definitely. Ina closed her restaurant at the end of 2013, she hasn't really retired. She's not a person who I think could quietly sit at home, or she's a person who does things all the time. And tell me, she's been very active in the period since she closed the restaurant, I understand.
Yeah, definitely. She has a column in the Chicago Tribune that's called Breakfast with Ina, I believe. And it's a monthly column where she reviews three different breakfast restaurants in the city. And so that's really great. And people I know love that. And then the film is actually, so we premiered at the Chicago International Film Fest in 2015. And we've been lucky to have had a festival run until it's still ongoing, which is incredible and great. Ina has been taking a lot of that on. She goes to a lot of the festivals. I'm actually 9 months pregnant right now, so I can't attend a lot of them, but she goes and people love her. I think they'd rather see her anyway, so it's a win-win. She also has been touring with her book and doing book readings.
Mm-hmm. I understand she also works with people dealing with post-polio syndrome.
She speaks for the Rotary Club. She has been really involved in the global eradication of polio. And so, yeah, that's something she's definitely still involved in. I know she writes for their magazine, The Rotatarian, and she does a lot of speaking engagements, talking about her own personal struggle with polio and post-polio and, you know, raising money and all of that. And I think it's her goal in life to see it globally eradicated.
Yeah. She's a really important character, I think, for us to know about, and I appreciate your spending the time with her and really telling her story in a beautiful way, I think. And we in Port Townsend are going to be lucky enough, if everything goes well, to meet Ina. She'll be out here with your film. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, I know she's really excited about it as well. Yeah, she'll be there for a Q&A, and people just love her. She loves people, so it comes out, you know. It's great.
Well, so. She's the kind of person that the Port Townsend Film Festival really loves also, and so I'm sure she will have a really good time because they treat our guests really well. So sorry that you can't be here, but you have more important things to do right now.
Right.
Okay, yes. Mercedes Kane, the director of Breakfast at Ina's, a film that's closing the Port Townsend Women and Film Festival this year, August 8th and 9th. Breakfast at Ina's screens on Sunday afternoon at about 1 o'clock. So look at the Women and Film schedule all around town or in the Port Townsend Film Festival website, and you will be able to find out about it. Thank you, Mercedes, for the film and for sharing your insights on it with us.
Yes, thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about it.
Thank you. You're listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM Port Townsend. I'm Larry Stein.
Every single person in here has incredible deep meaning to us. And it's really not about the first day of a restaurant, it's about the last. And this was the best last day ever. And it's all because you have been here with us for all these years. So thank you. I couldn't love you more.
I'd like to thank Mike Schlexer, our editor and engineer, Larry Stein, and all the amazing folks at Port Townsend's Film Institute, including Jeanette Force, Jane Julian, Victoria O'Donnell, and the McCall team, Chris and Pat. Go gently. If you can't go gently, go as gently as you can.